comment on our findings yesterday. For now, I can confirm that the search for Susie Barros will continue. I scrolled down, and against my better judgment, I read the comments under the article. Book Club Star 55. The missing Polish woman lived in a rented Wadebridge cottage, and now the police have found human remains on Wadebridge land. Everyone knows who managed that land for the owner, Michael Shaw. Come on, Notts Police, use your common sense. Footy fan, MU. Probably topped himself to avoid justice. Sarah J, 1968. Someone must have known what he was up to. Maybe his wife? Thomas Skinner. She was at the dig yesterday. Wouldn't look at anybody. Wonder why. My online viewing was cut short by an incoming call. The screen lit up with DI Helena Price, and I remembered I'd saved her number when she'd left me her card a while ago. Mrs. Shaw, she said when I answered. DI Helena Price here. I'm calling because I wanted to let you know myself that we sadly found human remains at the forensic excavation yesterday. Yes, I just read about it online on the Sentinel's website, I said frostily. Shame they couldn't have told me what to expect. I wonder if you'd be able to come into the station this afternoon, say 4 p.m. We have some questions we'd like to ask that could help our investigation. I sighed. Would this never end? I can be there for 4. Thank you. I also wanted to let you know some confidential information that the press aren't party to. I must ask you to keep this strictly to yourself for now. I understand, I said, holding my breath. As I said, we found human remains yesterday. Of 2 bodies. What? A recently deceased male with Polish identification papers and the remains of a female. Oh my God, no! I gasped, clamping my hand over my mouth. So they had found Susie Barros's body. My heart filled with pain for young Alex. The forensic anthropologist has confirmed the remains of a female child who died some time ago. The line fell silent as her words rang in my head. The remains of a female child. There was only one child gone missing in Linwick 23 years ago, and that was Matilda. Matilda Spencer, Donna's lost sister. Chapter 45. I put down the phone, trying and failing to digest what D.I. Price had told me. I was questioning myself, what I thought I knew about Michael, about Irene Wadebridge, the stories he'd told me about life growing up in the village. I knew memories of what happened to Matilda remained vivid to him. Michael would have been young when Matilda went missing. He'd have been 15. Old enough to do her harm if he'd wanted. I'd noticed Donna seemed to be fading every day. She was losing weight, her face paler than usual. Even her red hair seemed less vibrant, as if she was slowly turning into a shadow of her former self. It was the product of constantly fretting what Paul was up to. But what would this latest blow do to her? D.I. Price hadn't confirmed that the remains were Matilda's, but there weren't any other missing children that I knew of. It was obvious the male was Jakub Jasinski, but the police would not be drawn until they'd had official forensic confirmation, which could take several days, if not longer. I couldn't possibly tell Donna what I now knew. In the unlikely event that it wasn't Matilda after all, it would finish her off. For the sake of a few more days until the police findings were certain, I couldn't risk blowing her life out of the water. I was swimming, trying my best not to drown in grief for the husband I thought I'd known, worrying for my daughter's future. And in the middle of it all, Donna was slowly suffocating in her own past horrors. I went to see the doctor, and he's put me back on tablets for anxiety. He's also given me some strong sedatives to try and get me back into the routine of sleep, she told me a few days ago when I'd asked how she felt. Have they helped? The last couple of nights they've worked brilliantly, but I can't drive while I'm on them, so I won't be taking them for long. I feel trapped. Susie's disappearance had plunged her into the nightmare of 23 years ago when her beloved sister went missing. The tendrils of that time had always touched her present life, and although she didn't realize it yet, the tragedy was set to claim her once again. I fell into a restless nap on the sofa, waking up in a sweat, my heart beating twice as fast as before. I had to go to the shop. I'd neglected everything at home and had no food in for when Tansy came back later. As I came out of the supermarket car park with a bag full of goodies for the girls' tea later, I joined a short queue, waiting to turn right at the junction. I saw a familiar-looking silver BMW and watched as Paul sailed by, singing to some tune he was listening to. Contrary to what Donna had said about him taking Michael's death badly, he looked as if he hadn't a care in the world. Intrigued, I swapped lanes and turned left to follow him. There was one other car between us, and I slid in behind it. Donna had told me Paul was stuck at home in Zoom meetings all day, but it didn't look that way to me. He headed out towards the motorway, a couple more cars tucked in behind him. I could still easily see him, but my cover was improved. I pulled down my visor, even though it was dull outside and I could have done with more light in the car. He took the M1 north and immediately put his foot down. I increased my speed to the legal limit, but he was soon exceeding 70 miles per hour as he sailed ahead in the fast lane. I had no choice but to go at 80, which made me uncomfortable and strained the car. But I was aware we were approaching an exit, and if I wasn't close enough, I might lose him. In the event, though, he didn't take the exit, instead continuing north. I kept my foot to the floor and hoped for the best. I disliked motorway driving at the best of times, and I hated going too fast. My little Ford Fiesta was starting to shake, and I knew I couldn't keep it up for much longer. Then, to my relief, Paul started to move back across the lanes, decreasing his speed in readiness for exiting the motorway at Junction 29. I followed two cars behind him. He took the A617 for about a mile and then turned off onto a side road. There was only one vehicle between us now, and my heart pounded when the driver turned off and it was just me and Paul. I didn't want to blow my cover. I wasn't so close I was worried about him recognizing me in his rearview mirror, but I didn't know how observant he was about cars. Although he knew I had a red Ford Fiesta, it was hardly an unusual model. I watched as we passed streets packed full of houses. This was unfamiliar territory. I didn't know Chesterfield well, had only been there a handful of times, to restaurants on nights out, and to a good retail park on the outskirts. But we were off the beaten track here, on a housing estate. Was Paul going to visit someone? Donna was adamant she'd seen the signs of more infidelity. My heart started galloping. What would I do if this was it? The other woman's house? If she came to the door, would I get out of the car and start shouting? Of course not. So why had I come here? Paul had suggested they divorce in the heat of an argument, but still, if I found out he did have a mistress after all, it might be useful to Donna legally. I'd followed him here of my own volition, and now I felt nervous about what I might discover. I didn't like the thought of my friend being betrayed, but in her fragile state, this new knowledge could send her over the edge. But I was too far in to turn back now. I'd see it through, and if there was something untoward happening, then I'd sleep on it and decide what to do. I expected Paul to slow down at any moment and pull onto the driveway of one of the smart, new-build detached properties we were passing, but he kept on going. He turned left, turned right, drove straight on, and presently I sensed the area beginning to change. The houses were older semis, ex-council houses, and then, when he turned into yet another street, run-down terraces peppered with to-let signs. Some properties had several signs, which meant they had probably been converted to bedsits. We approached another junction, and then, unexpectedly, Paul slowed quickly and pulled over to the right, stopping the car outside a grubby-looking Chinese takeaway with a red closed sign hanging in the window. I hit the brakes, spotting a narrow side street to the left and turning in. He hadn't got out of the car yet, and I did a quick 3-point turn, so I was facing the right way to observe him. I turned off the engine and waited, glancing at the dashboard clock. It was 12:12. After a moment, he climbed out, smoothed a hand through his hair, and walked around to the back of the car. He opened the boot and took out a couple of bags of shopping and a supermarket bunch of flowers, then closed the boot and locked the car. It looked as if he was headed to the takeaway, but then he pushed open a peeling green gate at the side of the shop and disappeared down an alleyway. I looked up and down the street and saw lots of similar gates. It seemed we were in Bedsit Central. I reached for my phone, opened the camera, and zoomed in as closely as I could, snapping a photo of the gate. When I pinched the picture to zoom in, I saw there were two numbers painted on the gate, 13A and 13B. I waited. 12:22. And waited. 12:29. What if he was planning on spending the whole afternoon here? I wasn't going to wait around forever, and at least I had something for Donna if she needed to contact the other woman. Yet I couldn't quite bring myself to leave just yet. 12:38. The minutes ticked by slowly when you were waiting on someone with nothing else to do. I had my Kindle in my handbag and debated getting it out. Then, at 12:52, Paul emerged from the green gate. I snapped a pic or two for posterity as he stepped out onto the street. When he turned around, I saw there was someone else standing in the shadow of the alleyway. Paul said something, holding out his hands in a sort of, "What can I do?" gesture, and briefly, the woman stepped forward into the light. A small noise escaped my throat, and my hand flew to my mouth. With shaking fingers, I managed to snap a couple of photos. Then I dropped the phone. I pressed my head back into the neckrest as I made sense of what I was witnessing. The woman in the alleyway was Susie Barros. Chapter 46. I felt dazed. When Paul had driven away and Susie had disappeared back inside, closing the gate behind her, I sat in the car and just stared into space. I started to itch all over. All this time, all this upheaval of everyone looking for her. I'd started to fully believe Michael had done something terrible, and now here she was. She'd been hiding away, laughing at us. And all this time, Paul knew. I glanced at the clock. Tansy and Ellie had a dance and drama after school club until 4:30, so I still had some time before I had to be at home. Donna was picking up the girls, and then, after I'd been to the police station at 4, Ellie was coming back to our house for tea. But the girls' pizza was far from my mind right now. I wanted to call Donna and tell her everything. I wanted to ring the police and witness them hauling Susie out under a charge of wasting police time. I thought bitterly of the way they'd hounded Michael because they'd suspected he had something to do with her disappearance. I wanted to go in there and wring her skinny neck for putting Alex through torture while she enjoyed a torrid affair with Paul Thatcher. I didn't do any of that in the end. I just sat there, thinking everything through, until I felt I'd made the right decision. I got out of the car and locked it. Hooking my handbag over my arm, I crossed the road and approached the green gate, 13A and 13B. Which one? I pushed open the gate and walked down the dark, dank passageway. My footsteps echoed in the narrow space, and I shivered, more in anticipation of confronting Susie than because I was cold. At the end of the passage, there were two weather-worn brown doors leading off a tiny yard. Weeds sprouted up through the cracked concrete, and pizza boxes and beer cans lay in a sodden heap in the corner. I looked at 13A on my left and 13B on my right. Both looked equally drab and neglected. There were no doorbells, so I rapped on 13A. No answer. I tried again, but nobody came. I did the same with 13B, and a young man appeared, holding headphones in one hand and a phone in the other. "Yeah?" He looked to be in his early 20s. He had dark shadows under his eyes and was dressed in a grubby white T-shirt covered in stains and baggy cotton shorts. He peered at me blearily. "Sorry, wrong door," I said. Before I'd even finished speaking, he stepped back and closed it. I took a breath, pushed my shoulders back, and knocked again on 13A. I knocked and knocked and knocked. If I hadn't just seen her, I'd have left. But I knew she was in there, hiding away from a police investigation and from a very upset little boy. "Susie, I know you're in there. Answer the door. I'll stay here all day if I must. Maybe I'll just call the police." Bang, bang, bang. I had questions, and she had to answer them whether she liked it or not. It was time for her to be accountable for her selfish, deceitful actions. As I raised my fist again to batter the wood, the door opened, and Susie stood there. She looked scraggy and pale. Her hair had been cut, short and badly. The groomed image was gone. She wore torn jeans and a baggy jumper that was at least 3 sizes too big. We looked at each other. I clenched my jaw.
"Leave me alone," she said, her voice fearful. "You have no right to come here."
"I have every right to come here." I stepped forward, and she tried to slam the door shut, but I got my foot over the step and jammed it open.
"Go away! Go away or I'll...
"You'll what, Susie? Ring the police? I think they'll be delighted to learn you're safe and well. And what about little Alex? Will you speak to him too? Remind him he's got a mother? Maybe he'll be able to go to bed happy instead of crying himself to sleep."
"Stop!"
She covered her face with her hands. I stepped inside and she moved back, away from me. I closed the door, my nose wrinkling as I smelled damp and a sour, unclean odour. I was in a large, dirty room, a sink, oven, and tabletop fridge on one side, with a sagging 2-seater sofa and an upright dining chair arranged in front of a 3-bar fire. The place was freezing, the carpet covered in dark stains that had hardened the pile. "Why are you here?" I demanded. "What happened?" She balled her fists and opened her mouth, ready to have another go at me. "I'm not leaving until you tell me why you'd choose this hole above living in the cottage with Alex, who is suffering and missing you more every day." She just sort of deflated in front of me, as if all the stuffing inside her had dissolved. Then she sat down heavily on the sofa and pressed her face into her hands again.
"I don't know where to start," she wailed. "Paul wouldn't let me leave. He said I couldn't yet or I'd go to prison."
"Start from the beginning." I sat on the chair. I had to somehow let go of my obvious anger or we'd get nowhere. "Start with why you came over to England. And this time, let's have the truth."
"I met the love of my life at school," she said. "I was known as Anna back in Poland, short for Zuzanna. We were together from the age of 13. We lived in the same village, our families knew each other, and, well, it was always just assumed that one day we'd marry and have children. But when I was 18, my head was turned by another local man, Oscar. He had an air of excitement about him. He'd been living in another part of the country, and he was a bit flashy. I liked it. He made the other men look boring. Anyway, I ended up marrying him instead, and then we had Alex."
It all sounded fairly standard to me, but her face looked troubled.
"Years passed, and I realized Oscar wasn't who I thought he was. His smart image covered up a troubled man who liked to use his fists rather than talk. And he had some very dodgy contacts. His flash car and house had not been earned by working in a car factory, as I'd thought. It was through other dealings, of which I did not ask details."
Susie glanced at me, then looked away again, as though she felt ashamed to meet my gaze.
"I was trapped in a violent marriage. I wanted to leave with Alex, but Oscar said he would hunt us down, and when he'd finished with me, he would make sure no other man would want me."
"But you managed to get yourself to the UK?" I tried to keep my tone reasonable so I could get information out of her, but I wasn't sure I believed a thing she said. After all, this was a woman who had lied to everyone, including myself and her young son, when she staged her disappearance at the Christmas lights event.
I never forgot my sweetheart, and as each year passed, I regretted more and more my decision to leave him and marry Oscar. I went to see his family to ask for his contact details, and they told me they had not heard from him for 6 months. His mother said she was going to file a missing persons report with the UK police. I had this crazy urge to travel here to try and track Jakob down.
Without having any idea where this guy was, I said doubtfully.
Yes, it was, I don't know, just a feeling I had that it was now or never. I knew I might be too late, that something had happened to him, but I felt convinced I must try.
She looked down at her hands.
I would never forgive myself if I did not try.
I might have felt sorry for her if it wasn't for the image of Alex, sitting forlorn in his borrowed pajamas, with tears rolling silently down his face. She looked at me and said faintly,
"Did you know Jakob?"
"Not exactly," I said. I said hello to him a couple of times. Michael had hired him as a labourer up at Wadebridge. My words faded away as I made the connection. She'd come to Wadebridge to try and track down Jakob. He didn't turn up for work one day, and that was that. Michael said the foreign labourers often did that. They moved around. Sometimes they went back home. She nodded.
"Alex and I did a moonlight flit, I think you'd call it that here. Oscar was with his friends, drinking at some out-of-town bar. They had rooms booked, and he was due home in the morning. I'd known about the event for a few weeks, so I got everything ready for our escape. My parents had both died, and I couldn't tell anyone else we were leaving, because I didn't want them to have to try and hide information from Oscar."
She looked down at her hands.
"He can be a very persuasive man, in the worst possible way."
"Jakob's parents did not know you were coming out?"
"No. I was careful to tell them I wanted his details for a mutual friend who wanted to get in touch from school. The last thing I wanted was for Oscar to pressure them for information."
Susie nodded slowly.
"I made contact with several online Polish forums before I left for the UK. That was how I tracked Jakob down to the East Midlands. Everyone I spoke to, I asked them not to discuss our conversations with anyone. I explained I was fleeing a violent home situation with my young son. I was not the only one. Lots of women have done the same. I headed here and started my search, trying to find Jakob. Sorry, I need a breath."
She stopped talking for a moment and closed her eyes. I wanted to hurry her along, ask her if there'd been anything going on between her and Michael. She'd obviously moved on to Paul now, but I needed some questions answered about my own husband. I glanced at my watch. I was still okay for time.
I had not been in the UK long before I heard from friends back home, everyone asking where I was and saying that Oscar suspected we had gone to the UK. He was determined to hunt us down,
Susie continued.
I was terrified. I kept moving around, which was not good for Alex, and I was worried about his education. He became withdrawn and nervous. I could not make progress, no matter who I asked. Jakob seemed to have vanished into thin air. Nobody had heard of him. Nobody knew where he might be.
I thought about the first time she'd visited our house, her nervous demeanour, the feeling I had she was hiding from something or someone in her past.
"Then I got a breakthrough," she said. "Someone I'd been talking to on a forum emailed me with the name of a bed and breakfast establishment where he'd heard Jakob had stayed. I went there the same day. All the residents were Polish, but I hit yet another brick wall. Nobody could help me. I sat in the lounge there and just began to cry with frustration and sadness, and also fear that something very bad had happened to him. I thought maybe Oscar, in his jealousy, had paid someone to kill him. He is crazy enough, believe me.
She offered me a glass of water, but I declined. She fetched one for herself and sat down again.
Then a lovely man called Pavel came downstairs on his way out. I'll never forget his kind words. My dear, why are you crying? All my frustration about trying to find Jakob poured out. He took off his cap and jacket and sat down. He told me that Jakob had been his roommate, and that when Pavel had returned from his short trip home to Poland, Jakob had already gone without leaving any message or contact details. I asked him why no one else around there knew anything about him, and he said it was the way the Polish community did things. See nothing, hear nothing, he said. He said the police had been sniffing around, but his stock answer was always to say he knew nothing. She looked at me, seeing my confusion. There are people in our community who need to hide, people who are working illegally. We protect each other.
But he told you about Jakob. Susie nodded.
He said he felt sorry for me when he saw me in tears with my small boy. Thank God for that man. He told me Jakob had been working at a place called Wadebridge at the edge of a small village about 9 miles away, and that was all he knew.
So that's why you came to Linwick. You came looking for Jakob.
Yes. Pavel found out through his contact that Irene Wadebridge used an agency for home help. The agency employed many Polish workers. I registered with the same agency and stayed in a local B&B very close to the village. The manager swapped out one of the other workers who she had to pay travel expenses to and put me on Irene's rota. When I started work there, I found that Irene and I got on well together. She's a nice lady, and I genuinely liked her, liked working for her. She was brilliant with Alex, too. She offered me a cottage at low rents if I agreed to work for her directly. She was sick of having lots of different people coming from the agency. But when I asked about Jakob, she said she left all that to her land and property manager, that she had nothing to do with the hiring and firing of laborers.
And that's when you decided to get to know Michael. I couldn't say much more without wanting to choke her, but I had to keep her talking, had to find out everything I could.
Yes, I got chatting to Michael. I tried to find out about Jakob, but
hang on, you can't just scoot over Michael. I believe he died because of what he was about to be accused of. He was confused, panicked. He swore he was innocent, but the evidence was stacking up against him that he had something to do with your staged disappearance.
I am sorry, Kate. I just wanted to find out why he would not talk about Jakob.
It was more than that, though, wasn't it? I felt my breath shorten as I remembered all the evidence stacked up against Michael for a woman who was not missing at all. When you supposedly went missing, the police found his keys in your cottage. I found your phone in his toolbox. I feel terrible that I doubted him for a while, but now that I've seen this, I swept my hand around the room, the extent of your deceit, I'm asking myself, did you frame him? Did you want the police to think he had something to do with your disappearance?
Yes,
she cried out, then clapped her hand over her mouth.
Please, just listen to me. I tried asking Michael about Jakob, and he would not discuss it with me, ever. Irene had confirmed that Jakob had worked at Wadebridge, although she didn't know how well I knew him.
Irene also told me you had cozy afternoon tea breaks with Michael, and that you helped him by ringing suppliers. Irene told me you had a soft spot for my husband.
No, it is true I set up as many opportunities as I could to talk to Michael. That's the only reason I did these things. I had to find ways to speak to him, to try and get information about Jakob. Irene was mistaken. She thought my willingness to spend time with him was something else. My heart belongs to Jakob. Now I realize it always has. He's the only man I care about.
I laughed out loud, a harsh, bitter sound. Looks like it when you're now having an affair with Paul Thatcher, Always somebody else's guy with you. Donna used to say you were sly and one to watch, and my goodness, was she right.
It's not what you think,
she stammered, knotting her fingers together.
I tried to get information out of Michael because I knew something was wrong. He was holding stuff back about Jakob, I could tell. One day I tried to talk to him again, and he got annoyed. He said if I didn't stop bothering him about it, he'd speak to Irene and convince her to fire me and to throw me out of the cottage.
So there was nothing going on between you, I said faintly.
Truthfully, Michael could not stand the sight of me, but that made me angry and sad, and I ended up confiding in Paul. He fancied the pants off me, that much was obvious. I'd been friendly, but had not encouraged him. But this particular day, I bumped into him down in the village, and he asked what was wrong, and I ended up explaining that I was looking for my Polish friend, and I was absolutely certain Michael knew something but wouldn't tell me. And Paul came up with the plan.
Which was?
Kate, I'm sorry. If I'd known what was going to happen to...
What was the plan? I clenched my teeth.
Paul suggested I went missing for a short time, just for a few days. I'd leave some clues, enough for the police to interrogate Michael. Paul, in the meantime, would send an anonymous tip-off to the police, saying that Michael knew where Jakob was. He wouldn't be able to just ignore the police like he did me, you see. It would force him to talk.
She eyed me cautiously.
I'm sorry, Kate, I...
And the night you went missing, how did you do it?
I'd packed a bag with a change of clothes and a dark wig. Paul left them just inside the trees where I was standing. At the right moment, I dashed back into the trees, got changed, and waited at the other side until Paul picked me up to take me to the bedsit he'd rented. To all intents and purposes, it seemed I had vanished into thin air. But I still had second thoughts. I called Michael as he was leaving the event. After Irene had rung him about the potential flood.
Yes.
I told him I would give him one last chance to tell me what he knew about Jakob. I pleaded with him for ages, and at one point I really thought he would spill the beans. But then he told me to get lost and stormed off.
Michael must have explained that delay by saying he'd popped home first. The Ring video footage had proved otherwise.
And Alex, what would happen to your son while you did your disappearing act?
I told him that Mummy might have to go away for a short time, but that whatever happened, I would come back. No matter what people said, he had to remember that, but to keep it our secret. He was used to saying nothing about Poland, in case Oscar got to hear about us being in the vicinity, so this was just an extension of that. Paul assured me that he'd convinced Donna to take Alex in, and that it would only be for a few days anyway.
I still can't believe you did that to him.
Do you realize you could have done long-lasting damage to his mental health?
In a second, the mild-mannered Susie I knew had gone.
Not as much damage as living in a house where a brute regularly hit his mother and on occasion raised his hand to Alex, too.
She sneered.
You people see everything in black and white. You don't do this, you don't do that. In the real world, you do what it takes to survive. Alex having to lie about his past is a small price to pay to help us find a safe place, a life where we are not abused.
I'd had every intention of giving her a piece of my mind, but her words were powerful. My own childhood had been damaging, and I'd done what I needed to survive. I understood what she was saying, but her selfishness still staggered me.
Tell me about you and Paul, I said quickly, to move on. Are you together?
Susie pulled a face.
No way. But he thinks we will be when this is over. I haven't slept with him. I told him I wanted it to be special, not in this dump. But I kiss him, I have to. He says he's never met anyone like me, and that he loves me. I have to say the same. Plus, he is caring so well for Alex while I am away.
Is that what he's told you?
I gave a bitter laugh. You've been duped.
Alex has been in foster care for some time now. Your son is heartbroken without you. She let out a small noise like a distressed kitten.
No.
I took Alex in for a few days, and then when Michael died, Donna and Paul cared for him for a short time. Then social services insisted on finding him a temporary foster family. A tear traced its way down her pale cheek. You haven't been the first woman Paul's lied to, and you won't be the last, I said archly. Do you know he's told Donna he wants a divorce? Admittedly, it was in the heat of an argument, but you do well to remember there's a marriage and other people's feelings involved here. What you want is not the only consideration. I looked at her. She looked so thin, pale and vulnerable, but I couldn't forgive her for what she did to Michael and to Alex. Her jaw dropped. I swear I didn't know any of this. So you're saying Paul has got himself involved in all this because he's got the hots for you? Not quite. He told me he hates Michael, that he will never forgive him for telling tales about him to Donna. He's been waiting all this time to get revenge. Telling tales, as in revealing yet another one of his extramarital affairs? I blew out air. It sounds totally over the top to go to all this trouble. For both of you to lie and plan your disappearance, it wasn't supposed to go wrong, Susie groaned. Michael dying? And the massive police and press interest? We never thought it would blow up like this. Suddenly, I was trapped. I've had no phone or computer here. I get all my information about what is happening in the village from Paul. Come back with me now, I said. I'll go with you to the police. It's time for all this to end. But, Jakob, I need to find Jakob. I took a deep breath. I'm not sure how to tell you this, Susie, I said quietly. Yesterday, the police found two bodies buried at Wadebridge. They think one of them is Jakob. Chapter 47. I helped Susie get some stuff together. She'd agreed to come back to the house with me.
This has gone on too long, she said. If Jakob is dead, there is no point in me being away from Alex. It is time to come back.
Her face was tear-stained, and she looked beaten. So many people had been hurt, and for what?
Can we go straight to pick him up?
I shook my head. It doesn't work like that. The police are the first people you need to speak to. They'll have to call off their investigation, and you need to be aware you may be in trouble for wasting police time.
I have done wrong, and I know I must pay for that, but I need to see Alex.
The police will alert social services. They hold the key to you getting Alex back, one step at a time. She'd managed this long without seeing him, and my sympathy was in scarce supply. On the way back in the car, Susie carried on talking.
Pavel at the B&B has been good to me. He has been working to put out requests in the Polish communities throughout the UK to locate Jakob. Now I must tell him the sad news together with Jakob's mother. She will be heartbroken.
And what about Paul? I asked.
I'm not interested in him. My heart must heal from Jakob. He was the love of my life.
She looked so forlorn and sad, I almost wanted to stop the car and console her. But then I remembered the hell Michael had had to go through because the police had thought he had something to do with her disappearance, and the anonymous letter I'd got from villagers who believed the same. Poor Alex, whose suffering could stay with him for life. I kept on driving. We needed to sort this mess out, and fast. I pushed thoughts of Donna from my mind. On top of learning about Paul's treachery, there was the possible discovery of Matilda's body after all these years. I was seriously worried about her mental state. Now that I knew about Paul's involvement, I wanted to get Tansy back home as soon as I could. Ellie would probably need to stay with us too while her parents sorted out their mess. We parked up outside the house. I immediately noticed a battered old Ford Escort parked further up the road. We got out, and I squinted to try and get a better look. There were two men sitting in the car, and I suspected they might be press. "Let's get in the house," I said to Susie. "I've had reporters hanging around outside before." Inside, I made us drinks, and then, with a very nervous Susie by my side, I called DI Helena Price. There was no answer, and the call went to voicemail. "Hi, it's Kate Shaw here. I can't now come to the station at 4 p.m. There's been a big development, and I've just got back home. Please come to the house as soon as you can. It's important." Before Susie and I could sit down to talk, there was a knock at the door. I looked through the peephole and saw one of the men from the car up the street. "Go away! I'm not interested in speaking to you," I shouted through the closed door. "The police are on their way."
"I'm here to speak with Susie," a man's voice called out. "Tell her it is Pavel from the hotel."
"Please, let him in," Susie begged.
I opened the door. The second man stepped forward, and I gasped as I immediately recognized him. Susie let out a shocked noise and staggered back. Then she rushed at him and embraced him.
"Jakub, they told me you're dead."
The older man looked at me.
"I think we should leave them for a few minutes," he said in heavily accented English. "It is a long time since they were together. My name is Pavel."
I shook his hand. "Kate Shaw," I said. I hesitated a moment, keen to ask my own questions, then reluctantly led him into the kitchen. "How did you find him?"
"It has taken many months. I first put out a trace when the first lot of police came to the B&B about 6 months ago. Then, when Susie came, I tried much harder to find him. He had been working in Scotland, but he'd heard on the grapevine that Susie was over here and had made his way back to the area. He told me he'd even been to the woods near Wadebridge on the lookout for her after hearing she'd come over to the UK to search for him.
I suddenly remembered the mystery man in the woods. Sounded like Tansy had been right after all, for all my doubting her.
I had to see if this was confirmed before contacting her.
Why didn't you go to the police? He shook his head.
That is not the way we do things when there is a problem.
Jakob and Susie walked into the kitchen, hand in hand. The look of bliss on their faces at finding each other was so obvious, even I melted a touch, despite all the mess and heartache they'd caused. I felt a deep longing for Michael, and I swallowed it down with the rest of my grief. "The police should be here soon," I said. "Let's sit down and try and make a bit of sense of what's happened." Chapter 48. Nottinghamshire Police. Helena and Brewster walked along the corridor and stood outside Detective Superintendent Della Gray's office. "Ready, Brewster? We got all the facts, you reckon?" Helena reached out and straightened his tie.
"Ready, boss,"
he nodded. Helena knocked at the door and opened it. Gray looked up sharply and put down her pen. Her desk was placed in front of the window, but she sat with her back to the view of the open fields behind the station. Her ultra-short silver hair glinted in the light as she leaned back in her chair and folded her arms. "Take a seat, both of you. Where are we up to, Helena?" "As you know, the remains of two bodies were found at the forensic excavation, ma'am. An adult male and a young female, possibly a teenager." Gray gave a curt nod. "But still no sign of Susie Barros?"
"Sadly not. We're expecting fast-tracked results in 48 hours, but we're expecting that the remains are those of Matilda Spencer, a local girl, and Jakub Jasinski, who was reported missing 6 months ago, but hasn't been seen for about a year."
"Matilda disappeared after leaving school 23 years ago?" Gray frowned, picking up a piece of paper and reading the handwritten notes.
"That's right," Helena said. "And Jasinski disappeared without a trace also, followed by our latest vanishing resident, Susie Barros."
Gray put down her notes. "Unusual for a small village, to say the least. Any connection between the two victims?"
"Not that we can find," Brewster said.
As you know, Michael Shaw, the land and property manager up at Wadebridge, died in a road traffic accident 3 weeks ago. He's the only obvious link so far.
Shaw would have been just 15 when Matilda went missing, Helena remarked. That doesn't preclude him from taking her, but it would be unusual for someone to wait that length of time before abducting another victim, this time a fully grown man.
Hmm. Grey picked up her pen and tapped the desk with it. Family's been told yet?
That's our next job, Helena said, dreading the task. In circumstances like this, particularly in the case of children, families were usually told about the discovery to prepare them for the worst. Full confirmation would come when pathology results were received.
And Shaw's wife, Kate, is it? She was at the excavation, I understand.
Helena nodded.
We advised against it, but she turned up anyway. She's coming into the station at 4 today. After her admission, she knew Jakub Jasinski. We'll be questioning her under caution.
Married to Michael Shaw for 15 years and knew nothing about what he might have been up to, Grey said cynically.
Do we believe her?
Brewster spoke up.
If Shaw is the killer of both people, then it's hard to believe Kate didn't have her suspicions at the very least. But we've nothing solid as yet to connect her to the crimes, apart from possibly withholding evidence.
What about the owner of the land, Irene Wadebridge?
We're also speaking to her this afternoon, Helena confirmed. She also claims to not know much about what went on in the running of Wadebridge. A bit more believable given her age and health concerns.
Let's meet again tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, Grey said, picking up a document from her desk. Good luck this afternoon. Won't be easy for the Spencer family.
There's only Matilda's sister left, ma'am, Helena said, as she and Brewster stood up. Their father died 5 years after Matilda's disappearance, and the mother is in a nursing home, suffering from advanced dementia.
Sad, sad, Grey murmured, then pointedly went back to her paperwork. Walking back down the corridor, Brewster checked over his shoulder before saying,
I reckon the super has a rock where her heart used to be.
Helena grinned. She's all right. It's an act, I reckon. She's soft as grease underneath. Someone in uniform told me he saw her out with her two little pugs. They had pink ribbons in their fur and everything.
What? No way.
Brewster gave a hearty laugh, and Helena joined in at the unlikely picture forming in her head.
By the way, Helena?
They both visibly jumped as Grey called after them.
Make it 8:30 tomorrow. I have to walk my dogs.
No problem, ma'am, Helena said, swallowing hard. Grey's flinty eyes locked with Brewster's, and she gave a curt nod before ducking back into her office.
Do you think she heard?
Helena hissed, her eyes wide as she quickened her pace.
Nah, it's just coincidence, boss. Don't worry about it,
Brewster said unconvincingly.
Like you said, she's probably soft as grease at heart.
Brewster collected the pool car and Helena met him out front.
The Thatchers live on Main Street, in one of the larger houses leading into the village, she said, climbing into the passenger seat. Donna Thatcher runs the village tea room, so if she isn't home, she'll probably be there. Though I hope not.
The news they had to impart was best done in private, at Donna Thatcher's home.
I would think she expects the news to come at some point, Brewster said sadly. She must have known for years that her sister isn't coming back.
Helena sighed.
In my experience, Brewster, people never stop hoping. Hope is one of the most powerful human traits. But in a situation like this, it can add to someone's suffering. Until you get the worst news, there's always a chance, I suppose, no matter how slim.
Brewster flicked a switch, and a track from the best of Neil Diamond filled the car. At first, Helena was about to complain, but then she sat back and got lost in the music, trying not to think of the way she was about to wreck Donna Thatcher's day, her week, probably her whole year and beyond. 10 minutes later, Brewster turned into the sizeable driveway and parked behind a silver BMW. Helena got out of the car and took a moment to admire the traditional house, which had been built in the arts and crafts style,
Probably constructed towards the end of the 19th century, it boasted an asymmetrical roof and gable details that added a certain charm. It was the kind of house that she herself dreamed of owning when she met the right person and settled down. For now, though, she headed back each night to her two-bed terrace, with its leaky roof and small, soulless garden that she'd tried to pretty up with a few pots. She sometimes indulged herself with imagining how things might be in a few years when she met her life partner. One could dream, she always thought.
Ready, boss?
Brewster tipped his head, as if he was trying to guess what she was thinking. Sure. She pushed her shoulders back and stepped forward. Let's go. Brewster rang the bell, and a short woman with reddish-brown shoulder-length hair and freckles answered the door. The smile slid from her face when he held up his warrant card.
D.S. Brewster and D.I. Price from Nottinghamshire Police. Are you Donna Thatcher?
Yes, I... She looked back into the hallway. I'll step outside and we can... We'll need to come inside to talk, if that's okay, Mrs. Thatcher, Helena said quietly. Oh, I... Her eyes dimmed. This isn't about the dig yesterday, is it? This isn't...
If we could just step inside, Mrs. Thatcher, Brewster said, and put a foot over the threshold.
Course, sorry, come in. She glanced at her watch. Just so you know, I'm doing the school run today, but I've got some time. Come through.
It seemed to Helena like someone had wound Donna Thatcher up like a clockwork toy, and she was scurrying around with no direction in mind. She led them into a bright, airy kitchen with modern grey shaker units and a wall of bifold glass overlooking the garden.
Is anyone else home with you now? Brewster asked. Or is it just you?
My husband's upstairs in his office on a work call. He sells kitchens, travels a lot. This is one of his.
She waved a hand around. He's good at what he does. He just, well, the job takes a lot of him.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You must think me rude. Would you like tea or water or...
Helena stepped forward and placed her hand on Donna's arm.
We're fine. Please, sit down for a moment, Mrs. Thatcher. We have something important to tell you. No, don't tell me. What is it? Is it about that dig? Is there any news on Susie?
Helena spoke slowly and calmly. Yesterday, we carried out a forensic excavation on the Wadebridge land. We found human remains and...
No!
Donna croaked.
It's not her, is it? It's not...
I'm so sorry, but we believe we may well have found the remains of your sister, Matilda Spencer. Donna Thatcher opened her mouth and tipped back her head, and a chilling wail emerged. The hairs on the back of Helena's neck bristled, and she noticed that even Brewster, who seemed immune to noise, shrank back slightly. Donna cut off the wail and looked to the door, perhaps worried she'd disturb her husband's call. Helena watched as she took a breath and gathered herself.
Forensic tests are currently being carried out using DNA comparison, Brewster said. We can't confirm 100% until we have the results of those, but the remains are consistent with a young female matching Matilda's details.
What did you find after all this time?
Donna's hands flew to her mouth.
What's left of her?
Don't do this to yourself, Mrs. Thatcher, Helena said softly. Best to remember Matilda as she was. Helena had seen photographs and read descriptions of Donna's sister, and it was clear that her most prominent feature had been her vibrant red hair. When Helena had peered into the dank, deep hole at yesterday's excavation, only small, dirty bones remained of a young girl who was raised with love and tender care by a sister who clearly still grieved her as badly as the day she disappeared. Chapter 49. Back in the car, Helena and Brewster sat in silence for a few moments, waiting until the negative energy finally began to flake away.
Christ, that was tough,
Brewster said, blowing out a long breath.
Very tough, Helena agreed, She took a breath. Onwards and upwards, Brewster. Time for us to speak to Irene Wadebridge. Brewster started the engine and reversed back down the driveway, pausing at the bottom to check the traffic. Clear this way, Helena said, and he swung the car out into the road and accelerated.
I could pick us up a coffee and a muffin on the way if you fancy it, he said, hopefully. Helps to keep the blood sugar up, see? Useful when we're doing this sort of work.
Luckily, I've got an apple in my bag, Helena said, reaching in to check her phone. But it was a nice thought, Brewster. His face dropped, and she heard his stomach growl. Let's get the Wadebridge visit over, then you can pick something up to scoff before we go to see Kate Shaw. How's that sound?
Sounds super,
he responded glumly. Helena tapped on a notification and listened to the voicemail message. Great. She tossed the phone back in her handbag. That was Kate Shaw. She isn't coming into the station at 4. Says there's been a big development and could we call at her house?
Out of order, Brewster scowled. Wonder what she classes as a big development.
Well, now we're almost here. We'll speak to Irene Wadebridge and we'll swing by the Shaw's house on our way back to the station. Up at Wadebridge, they knocked at the door and waited. When there was no answer, Brewster knocked again.
Doesn't look like there's anyone.
Hang on. Helena inclined her head and turned her ear towards the door. I thought I heard something. A voice called out.
Nearly there. One moment.
They heard a bolt sliding and a key turning on the other side. Then the door opened slightly and Irene Wadebridge's face peered out.
What can I... Oh, it's you, Detective Inspector Price. Come in. Come in, dear.
She glared at Brewster, at the food stain on his lapel.
You too, if you must.
Helena grinned at Brewster's exaggerated expression of offence as she walked past him and stepped inside the house. The air was fusty in here. Not damp, just old and stale from lack of ventilation. Filled bin bags and piles of folded newspapers lined the hallway, reducing the ample floor area down to a narrow strip.
Come through to the kitchen, Irene said, shuffling ahead with the aid of a stick. My arthritis is playing me up today, so I'm afraid I'm not up to making drinks.
Would you like a cup of tea? Helena said when they got to the kitchen. Brewster will do the honours. She flashed him a smile.
Oh, how kind. That would be lovely.
Irene looked at him.
Half a teaspoon of sugar, please, and I'm a little particular about the milk. Just a splash, but don't make it too strong. Oh, and milk in first for me. Semi-skimmed. Can you remember all that?
I think I can just about manage, Mrs. Wadebridge, he said dryly.
Helena looked away and smothered the laugh that bubbled up into her throat. Let's sit down, Helena said, extending her arm. Do you need any help?
No. I'm fine getting around, just slow,
Irene frowned.
Doris should have been here this morning, but she's had to take her cat to the vet. The poor creature has had hairball problems yet again, but she's coming over later.
Well, if there's anything we can do for you in the meantime, just let me know, Helena said. She waited until the elderly woman had sat down in a worn but comfy-looking armchair, before taking a seat next to her on an equally ragged sofa. Now, Mrs. Wadebridge, as you know, please, call me Irene. As you know, Irene, we carried out a forensic excavation in a field here yesterday afternoon.
Yes, and nobody said a word to me afterwards, you know,
Irene said, looking rather put out.
I expected to hear all about what was found, but you lot just cleared off, sticking a notice through my door telling me not to go near the excavation site. Only the reporters were any help.
Oh, really?
Yes. A nice man from the Mansfield Sentinel came to the door. He said the police had found something, possibly Susie Barros's body. It's most upsetting.
Did he now?
Brewster said from over by the kettle.
It's best not to speak to the press, Mrs. Wadebridge. They'll tie you up in knots with their theories.
I only spoke to him because he reminded me a bit of Michael, that sort of kind, sensible air he had about him.
She stared at her hands and fell silent. Brewster brought the tea over and placed it in front of Irene on a low table. "You must miss Michael," Helena said softly.
"I miss him terribly," she said, without looking up. "I've known him since he was a young man, you know. Amos, my late husband, he always thought highly of him too. With us not being able to have any children of our own, Michael became sort of an adopted son. Then I lost my Amos, and now Michael's gone too."
Helena nodded. "I understand." Irene looked up, and Helena saw that her eyes were full.
"Michael took care of everything, you see. He sorted out the cottages and the land, and in his own way he took care of me too. Sometimes he'd just sit and have a chat over a cup of tea, but it made such a difference to my day."
Helena took a breath. Often the antidote for loneliness in older people was simply a matter of a few minutes of chat, a smile, maybe passing the time of day on the street. If only people with busy lives understood that kindness, however brief, could linger and get a soul through a long, quiet evening. Helena forced her attention back to the job in hand. This next bit wasn't going to be easy, but it was very necessary.
"Irene, I'm so sorry, but we're here today to inform you that we did indeed find human remains on your land."
Irene clamped a hand over her mouth.
"Oh, that poor girl. How awful."
"It's not Susie Barros," Helena said.
"We believe we may have found the remains of Matilda Spencer, who lived in the village and went missing one day after school, 23 years ago,
Brewster said. Irene cried out,
"I thought you were going to say it was Susie. That's terrible, truly terrible."
She took a tissue from her sleeve and dabbed at her eyes.
"The poor girl's family. I'm outraged that whoever did this chose to bury her on Wadebridge land."
"We also found the body of a Polish man, who we believe to be Jakub Jasinski," Brewster continued. "The man who worked here for 2 years, who you claim not to remember."
"Goodness, yes."
Irene raised an index finger into the air.
"The shock of it must have jogged my memory. Michael was annoyed because he'd given Jakub a chance and then he'd just gone off like that."
Helena watched her carefully. It seemed Irene had miraculously recalled all the details now that she'd realised they'd uncovered Jakub's remains and could no longer deny he'd been there.
"Irene, I have a question that's going to be difficult to hear, but I'm hoping you understand it has to be asked," Helena said earnestly. "Do you think Michael Shaw had anything to do with the deaths of Matilda Spencer and Jakub Jasinski? Do you think he may have abducted Susie Barros?"
Irene opened her mouth to answer, then hesitated.
"I loved Michael like a son, you know. I've protected him when I shouldn't have. He had a terrible temper that showed itself sometimes. Nobody would have believed it, the way he could blow up over this or that."
"Can you give us an example?"
Brewster prompted.
"If someone irritated him or didn't do something he wanted them to, he could get quite annoyed."
Irene fell silent before speaking again, her voice low and serious.
"So, in answer to your question, I'd say yes. I would imagine Michael could be responsible for those deaths. Only he had access to the land. Nobody else could bury two bodies out there without his knowledge."
"Matilda has been there a long, long time," Brewster reminded her. "Michael would have been just 15 years old.
Irene frowned.
"He was a strapping lad at that age. His father knew Amos. Michael used to come up here regularly with his dad."
"And Susie Barros?" Helena added.
"Between you and me, I have my suspicions Michael had something to do with her disappearance too," Irene said faintly.
"Why were you suspicious?"
"Well, he was always talking to her, acting shifty when I asked what they'd been chatting about.
I've known him long enough to see when he's trying to hide something.
And yet you've never mentioned any of this to us or any of the police officers who've been working up at Wadebridge.
Brewster frowned. Hindsight is the perfect science, she said softly. I have what you might call an old-fashioned trust in people. Irene pulled a tissue out that had been tucked under the cuff of her cardigan. She dabbed her eyes. It seems I was harboring a monster here in Michael, and I didn't even realize.
There was something very off about her reaction, if you ask me, Brewster said when they were back in the car. There wasn't a single tear there when she dabbed at her eyes, and she seemed to be thinking a lot before she answered your questions.
She might just be nervous, Helena said, clicking on her seatbelt. But I tend to agree. She wasn't remotely as upset as I thought she might be.